When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my co-host, the medical miracle, the eighth wonder of the world, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
That's me.
It is. And I'm your other co-host, Mark Bigney. Further Stalag updates. I'm finding this topic fascinating. Last week, I gave you the update of the more successful English mnemonics for stalagmites and stalactites. So, I pointed out that the English mnemonic never really did anything for me, but there was a slightly more successful one that stalagmites are on the ground and stalactites are on the ceiling, but the problem there is you have to remember how they're spelled. Here, though, is another one relying on spelling, but it's easier to remember. So stalagmites, everyone remembers that's the one with the M, and stalactites, everyone remembers that's the one with the T. If you write them down, especially in all caps, but even in lowercase as well, an M looks like stalagmites on the ground, whereas a T looks like it's hanging down from a... There you go.
No, I just made one up.
No? No? You remain unmoved by this?
I made up a current...
No. Back up.
Yeah, that is good. M
it is okay, good. I'm glad you...
But the bottom of the M sort of comes down too, though. Credit.
What?
The bottom of the M sort of comes down is also sort of a pointy thing, so it's sort of up and... So you could get confused.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I thought you
about.
Said this might...
Uppercase.
Yeah. But if you look at the bottom, there's also a point coming down.
Yeah, there's just a point coming down. You have to ignore the literal triangles pointing upwards.
All right. More current.
Okay.
Rocks on the ceiling are tight.
Rocks on the ground could be tight, too. That's the problem. Yeah. So this is a board gaming podcast about board games. We're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our feature game, which is The Veil of Eternity. Now, this is V-A-L-E, not V-E-I-L.
Mark, just, we are civilized here.
Just to point out. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we got to play Voyages of Marco Polo. This is designed by Simone Luciani and Danielle Tizzini and put out by Hans M. Gluck, but more likely you're playing a Z-Man Edition game. And in Marco Polo, you are voyaging.
Yeah.
You're voyaging around with your broken powers, putting out trading huts. You're trading all sorts of goods. You're spending camels like they're going out of fashion. And you're having a good time because Marco Polo is great.
It's been too long since we've played The Voyages of Marco Polo. And it's one of those games where you don't have nearly as many actions as you might like. And one of the things that I appreciate about it is that despite the fact that it's very much in sort of the modern Euro idiom, it is relatively straightforward to set up. And all the trailing bits, the endless series of different kinds of tokens and weird things, they key off of various special powers that get triggered. And so it's like an endless buffet of toys. So, for example, you started off with your little pile of tokens that were primarily for your benefit. And then about halfway through the game, Huey stumbled across, wait, what are these? Oh, those are shortcut cards. And then you go and go in the box and you get the shortcut cards. Here are your toys that you get to play with now. I personally, as somebody who's usually in charge of some amount of the setup, find this preferable to a more traditional Euro setup where it's like, separate the tiles out into three piles. shuffle them separately and organize them. Oh, but remove two at random from each pile. And then, and it's just, you know, you do all that at the setup and you have all this stuff. But Marco Polo is more like a buffet of random nonsense. And I personally approve of that, when, especially when layered on top of a relatively tight action selection mechanism that it has with the dice.
Yeah, very. You have this pool of dice and you need to figure out how you're going to use them, because the dice are used in all sorts of different ways in this game. It's not sort of you need dice to do actions. You need sets of dice and stuff like that. You get bonus dice. You spend camels to do all sorts of things with dice, because camels change dice. It's well known. This is known.
Camels do a lot of things. Sometimes you ride camels so hard you have to leave them by the side of the road on the way to Marrakesh. You know, it's a problem. Sometimes you use the camels to change dice. Sometimes you use the camels to turn into dice. It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. That is The Voyages of Marco Polo. And I was very much in a middleweight Euro dice placement to move around kind of mood, because we also played Pulsar 2849, which is also a middleweight Euro where you spend dice and place dice and you move around. And there are also fewer toys. Fewer toys in Pulsar 2849, but still a fair amount of interesting things to go around and do. This is my favorite Vladimir Suki design. It was published in 2017 and distributed in English by CGE. And ultimately, it's, you know, the space theme does a little bit, because I do enjoy science fiction, but mostly it's the dice drafting that I really appreciate about Pulsar 2849. You arrange all the dice out in order, and if you draft a die that is significantly higher or lower than the average, you move up or down these tracks. And these tracks, there's only two of them. It's not like I need to get to level 15 to go and get that Benny there. And these are purely competitive tracks with the other players, and they determine how many cubes you're going to get, which power any number of different actions and give you tremendous flexibility, and or turn order, which is very consequential, given that the dice are quite restrictive. I actually find the dice restrictions in Pulsar 2049 to be very strong and much appreciated. Very often in dice games, like how I complained about River of Gold, last week. It's like, oh, I felt the dice were really impeding my ability to do anything. Pulsar 2849 is more like, well, I only have a limited ability to modify these dice. Let me figure out what I can get done with these things.
Yeah, you really need some focus in Pulsar, because there's endgame goals, and so you sort of have to drive towards those, but you have to really look at what dice are available and if you want to go up and down those tracks. And then there's a variety of other things you can do while you wait for dice that you actually need. It's like, do I want to sacrifice my bonuses that can manipulate the dice now, or just hold off and do these other things like get techs that are going to make these actions better later?
Absolutely. It's just shy of point salad for my preferences. You know, there's a fair amount of different scoring to be had, but I think it's just focus enough for my taste. And that is one of the ways in which I tend to get off of Vladimir Suki games. You know, I do tend to feel that they're generally well-designed. I don't think I've ever played a Vladimir Suki game and felt, oh, this was imbalanced, or the mechanisms didn't really cohere in any kind of way. But generally, I find his themes uninspired, and I find a lot of the process of playing his games to feel interchangeable, whereas I think that Pulsar 2849 is sufficiently different, and that dice drafting just makes me very, very happy. So I was glad to get it back to the table. Pulsar 2849 by Vladimir Suki. A solid middleweight Euro that I'm glad to have in my collection.
Speaking of interesting action selection, let's talk about Faeum, a game we both played as well. This is designed by Friedman Fries and put out by 2F Spiel, which does all of Friedman Fries' F, beginning with F games.
Which is to say, pretty much all his games.
All his games. And so you have this hand of cards to start, and there's going to be this pool of cards that is constantly cycling throughout the game. And then you play the cards to do the actions. And then when you want, you can pick up your cards, but you only get to pick up three for free. So it's a very much a game where you're deciding how to order your cards, how they go down. Are you just going to get this combo that it cycles the same three cards back and forth? Are you going to start cycling a lot of cards? Anyway, lots to do. All sorts of different abilities with the cards, because you're populating this map. And the interesting part is that you don't populate it for you. You just sort of put out these pieces, and then everyone can play these unique actions that manipulate and work within those pieces.
At its best, sadly this doesn't happen too often, but at its best, Faeum kind of delivers a unique bespoke economy every game. So, for example, in this case, we had hardly any towns or workshops. Settlements abound. Generally speaking, you've got lots of settlements. But very few of the settlements were connected to each other. and we didn't have a whole lot of workshops, and we didn't have a whole lot of towns. And that influenced what cards were useful and what cards were especially helpful. For example, near the beginning of the game, we had a whole bunch of cards that were very, very lucrative with respect to placing workers at or making improvements to workshops. They all got burned out of the system automatically because the cards that actually made workshops came up later. This was not restrictive because nobody was bound to a workshop strategy, or no one was in a position of taking the risk of building a workshop or doing something hoping that these cards would come up later. We knew just on the face of it, it's like, this game isn't going to shake out that way. And so consequently, the economy gets to develop in different ways, and you get to be reactive to a certain extent. The card cycling, as you say, is very interesting. I was in a position midway through the game of realizing that I had purchased way too many cards, and consequently my ability to cycle cards and or get income was seriously curtailed. I had to decide whether I would take a couple of inefficient turns just so I could bury those cards I didn't want at the bottom of my stack and never retrieve them ever again, or lump the fact that I was never going to get income ever again and just keep them in my hand forever. I decided on the latter. I'm not sure it was the right call, but things kind of shook out okay. We didn't play with the expansion, though, but we did play with the most important gameplay improvement possibly ever, which is the Michael Walker Googly-Eyed Crocodile expansion.
What can I say? I don't know how anyone could play Fame without it, really.
I'm amazed it took me this long.
I know.
I've been talking about how I wanted to try Fame with the expansion. Really, what I should have been saying is, let me have some of them googly eyes.
Now, we haven't talked about another extremely interesting and cool part, which is the end game, because there's something that's going to trigger the end game. And when the end game is triggered, you don't get to do that card cycling thing that we just talked about. You're going to be locked into the cards you happen to have in your hand at that time. And getting that timing just right, and then the fact that, sorry, you're not locked into the cards that you have at that time, because you are able to purchase the cards that are still left in the pool. So you can sort of extend your game by purchasing cards, but eventually you're going to run out of money or usable cards that are there. Anyway, I love that sort of end game sort of finish up mechanism.
It is clever. And on top of that, there are these disasters, and so you can pull the ripcord and exit the game before other people and get more points. Or if by the time you're one of the last players left standing, there's no reason not to just play out all your cards and get suboptimal actions out of them. Fame is really interesting. Friedman Fries is a game designer who's really come into his own. I mean, I say this all the time. I didn't like a lot of his early work. Fearsome Foes and Power Grid and things like that weren't really to my taste. But his later work is shockingly interesting and unique and diverse in its application. Usually light to middleweight Euros, but often a couple of things that you haven't seen elsewhere. And just done with a sense of whimsy. You know, even before you put googly eyes on the crocodiles, just the way the crocodiles work are already kind of whimsical as it is. And so I really appreciate checking out what Friedman Fries is up to. I'm very glad that he's been releasing a lot of things lately, and I hope to continue to see new and unique offerings from Friedman Fries. That is Fame. More Mark Games with Children news, and no, I'm not talking about Michael Walker. Ha ha!
Oh, zinger! Wow!
Oh, indeed. Right out of left field. I played another session of Micro Macro Crime City All In. Now, children are often... they're not often good at identifying what's good for them. I think we can all agree on that. Whether you're pro-child or anti-child, I think we can all agree they're not necessarily the best stewards of their own self.
Lifestyle choices might be lacking.
Precisely. And so when one of the 2 6-year-olds with whom I was playing Micro Macro Crime City said, I want to do this case, and took out the eponymous All In case, I looked at it and had 5 stars on it, which would say maximal difficulty. And I said, I don't think you want to try this one. This is the hardest case in the box. Last time we played a 2-star case, and now this is a 5-star. I don't think we should do that one. And they insisted, Walker. Another thing that children are often not known for is their flexibility and their ability to compromise. So they insisted. It did not go well. Now, it is still a delight to just look at Micro Macro Crime City and just look at the little vignettes there. Now, and children love to do that, but they would frequently get distracted from the case, which is fine. I was not going to be like, come on, guys, we've got an agenda here. No, that's fine. But the problem is that, for me, the higher difficulty cases in most of the Crime City sets don't emphasize what I like about Crime City. What I like doing in Micro Macro Crime City is following the path of somebody and establishing a kind of narrative and continuity about what happened. The more difficult cases are often more about find Waldo and spot this one scene where that happens to give you the clue to figure out what happened, rather than just being able to tail them or construct a linear narrative. It's more like, well, In this particular case, there was a crime that occurred in one section of the city, and you have to find out who did what, when, to whom. And to do that, you needed to literally just find the location of two specific individuals way on the other side of the city, and there was no picture of them in between. And so the higher difficulty ones are more about spot the hidden detail in the map full of details, rather than tracing backwards or finding some connective tissue. And so consequently, I find the higher difficulty cases less to my liking. Not just because they're more difficult, but because they involve that specific process. Lower on the narrative, more on the scanning a large scene to find the details. Suffice to say, we abandoned the more difficult case halfway through, and then we went to an easier case. That went much better. So their attention kind of waned in the middle of the more difficult case, but nonetheless, they're like, we want to do a different one, as opposed to let's do something else. So that's at least worth pointing out. And also, there were several more sessions of who's the banana? Here's the problem. I think I created a monster. I trained them how to deceive me better in who's the banana. Just as a weird rhetorical flourish, when attempting to emphasize that I had the banana, I believe at the time I didn't. I was just like, no, look, it's a banana. It's right here. It's yellow. It curves. It says B-A-N-A-N-A. Sorry, banana. I think that might have worked as a deception on the six-year-old. I felt great being able to pull the wool over eyes. But then they started copying this technique. The problem is when you're six and you're trying to spell banana, and it's not written in front of you, your eyes start drifting off into the middle distance. And I was able to say, look, buddy, if you pretend you're reading the card, but you're staring off into the distance trying to remember how to spell banana, it ain't going to work. Sure enough, they learned. And this session, they would stare fixedly at the card and say, it's a banana, B-A-N-A-N-A, banana. I'm like, oh, okay, you've got the banana. Nope.
Oh, nice.
I created a monster. So that is further experience with Who's the Banana? Probably the most efficient social deduction game on the market today. Designed by, full disclosure, a personal friend of mine, Chris Cheslick, is Amati Games. You can play with any copy of When There's a Banana, and I recommend it.
So back to Micro Macro. I should give you half of my chips. I recommend this to everyone. I have these bingo chips, like clear bingo chips, and they're just great for sort of tracking your case. So if you want to like backtrack to where you were, not only that, because they're clear sort of colored bingo chips, they slightly magnify what's underneath them.
Oh, cool.
So you can place them all in your points of interest, and then you can sort of backtrack or figure out what you're doing. And like I said, it slightly amplifies it.
Yeah.
It makes it very interesting.
That was not, I don't think that at all addresses the difficulty I have with the higher difficulty cases. Indeed, the problem isn't that I was losing where we were. It's like, again, there was this crime that happened in one area of the map, but the detail that the clue card wanted us to find was utterly unconnected. There was no trail to follow. It was just
I don't say specifically fix a hard. I'm just saying that if it says, you know,
so what I say doesn't matter. This is new time. This is,
no,
this is the
I'm
Michael
saying,
Walker
not,
show.
I don't think
Michael
it would.
Walker
I was agreeing with you. It wouldn't fix that particular problem.
But okay.
Where it says, you know, where did this person come from?
Sure.
And so you follow this long trail to see where they came from. And then it'll say, well, what did they use for the murder weapon? And now you have to go all the way back to where the murder took place.
Sure.
And then instead of trying to find it, now you have these chips, you know, on the map. Anyway, we all streamed for Rats of Whistar, not Secret of Nim. All right? This is designed by Simone Luciani and Daniel Saba and put out by Cranial Creations. And it is an interesting game where has very basic actions. You know, you're either digging holes or you're putting bedrooms in those holes, which will give you more mice. And you want the mice because it will make these actions more powerful.
Are they mice or are they rats?
Rats, I guess.
Yeah.
The tokens look much more like mice, though. Big round
true.
Ears.
And, that is and, true.
Because when you take these actions, there's sort of this three-segment wheel. Sorry, multiple-segment wheel, but three areas around the wheel. And depending on how many rats you have in those segments is how powerful that action is going to be. So you have five rats there and you collect the metal action. Well, you're going to get five metal. And so you're doing all these different actions. You're searching through the farmhouse to get electricity. You have your big house inside the rose bush. You're trying to distract the cat dragon. You're going to see Nicodemus in the alchemy hut. So you're doing all these things. The game will end before you know it. Man, we blew through that game. It's only five rounds. And man, you go awfully fast. Anyway, love Rats of Whistar. I hope we get to play it more.
How explored was the big house?
Oh, fully. We got
good.
Well, it was the same sort of sniping that took place. Someone was nice enough to open all the doors to get there, and then everyone else rushed in and sniped all the goodies.
Yeah, I remember there being a bit of a tension. You do get a bonus for opening the doors, kind of, but it doesn't quite seem worth it. It's one of those situations where, depending on how the movement values shake out, the people who arrive later might be able to benefit more from the situation.
In this case, it did benefit me. I did have a card already that was giving me bonus victory points for each door token I had in the game. So I didn't mind it so much.
You were talking about yourself there.
I was.
It was so subtle, I couldn't tell.
I know.
Wow. What a noble, self-sacrificing little rat you are.
I was. So all sorts of very fun and whimsical inventions that you can have during the game that do all sorts of different things. I recommend it. Rats of Whistar.
Closing out my anthropomorphic animals experience for the week was Raccoon Tycoon. This is a game that was requested by virtue of the adorable animals in old-timey robber baron costumes. For example, the eponymous Raccoon Tycoon. There's also Fat Cat Railways and Top Dog Railways and Skunk Works if you play with five players. But we did not play with five players. I've yet to play with the Skunk Works. It's the obvious skunk-related pun. And it's a very simple economic game, but it has one of those elements that I really appreciate in auction games, which is timing. About having cash when you need it, and therefore being able to exploit that advantage. There's a floating market for supply and demand. You can get goods just by playing a card that automatically replenishes itself. So all that it costs is your turn. You're accumulating goods until you eventually sell goods for their market value, and that typically causes the price to tumble. And then you've got a fat load of cash, which is useful not just because of the things you can buy for it, because if you have lots of money and nobody else does, you can start snatching things up on the cheap, because all the things that generate lots of points are auctioned off. And so you have the ability to call an auction when you're rich and nobody else is, and just delight in the fact that everyone's a couple steps behind. Now, you then have to spend some of that money on a variety of good things, and then the tides might be turned based on the overall tempo. So managing that flow of tempo is one of the things that I really much appreciate about Raccoon Tycoon. That and the fact that it's got a very simple and very effective supply and demand mechanism for the floating values of goods. And it does matter. It's not just like, well, I'm going to be making $35 or I'm going to be making $42. This could be the difference between making $14 and making $32 in many cases. And so timing is everything in Raccoon Tycoon. The value of your turn is far greater than the value of anything else you might have. And that makes for a dynamism driven by player choices, which is ultimately one of the things that I like in games of this ilk. Now, it's still very light and a very, very approachable game. But frankly, I think those are appealing features of it. And when compared to other more complex, laborious games, like, for example, Kutna Ora, where I never really felt the supply and demand mechanism shook out to be particularly consequential, I'll take Raccoon Tycoon any day of the week. So this is another design by Glenn Drover, he of Mosaic and Empire's Age of Discovery. And this is one of the designs of his that I thoroughly appreciate. Raccoon Tycoon by Glenn Drover and Forbidden Games of 2018.
So the new edition of Yokohama is out. And so I felt like playing some Yokohama, and they do have on Board Game Arena. So I loaded that up and invited some people. So Yokohama is a very interesting sort of, I don't want to say worker placement because it's not directly worker placement, but you're scattering these workers around the board.
Not entirely unlike Rats of Whistar. The more workers you've got there, the better the action's going
to
go.
But you also need them to trace a path, because as you move your boss around, you have to move through your workers to the action that you want to take. And all the actions are sort of different buildings within Yokohama.
Are we meant to infer that the boss is being literally conveyed by the workers on their shoulders or something?
Well, it's like you walk. You don't walk on the ground, Mark, when you're a boss in Yokohama.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't know.
All right. So these actions are going to give you tech. They're going to let you get resources that are going to let you fill orders, but all these things that you're collecting all have symbols on them as well from different countries, because it's a major trading town, so all these different people are coming in, and so you want to have these sets of all these different countries. It's going to give you points and also gives you bonus actions when you get so many of them. I love everything about Yokohama, the way you get techs, the way you spend the resources. The fact that when you have a certain number of workers in an area, you also get to put trading posts there, which makes the powers that much more powerful as well. You have to sort of clean off your sheet. You want to have you have extra workers on your board as well that you want to get out into the town because, you know, you're going to run out. You get to place three a turn or two in one area. As long as you have them, that's the thing, right? So anyway, Yokohama, if you haven't had a chance to try it, new edition out. It's also on Board Game Arena. The one I have is from Tasty Minstrel Games.
I should play it again. I only played it the once, and I remember not fully internalizing the end scoring conditions, and so consequently not really feeling like I was doing anything very deliberately. But I should definitely play it again.
That was definitely the problem in our game, because there was no undo in our particular game. And I clicked a button that pulled my leader off the board, which pretty well takes you out for an entire turn.
Ah.
Which sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Not wrenched good. My whole game. But that's okay. Yokohama.
So I used to read to expand my mind. I gave up on reading a while ago. It's a sucker's game. Now everything I need to learn, I learn from popular culture.
I think there's a YouTube video on that. Just probably just watch it.
Ernie Hudson has taught me that if somebody asks you if you're a god, you say yes. And Casper Lapp has taught me what gods want, and gods love dinosaurs. And Gods Love Dinosaurs is not entirely unlike Raccoon Tycoon, a very, very simplified take on a well-worn genre. Raccoon Tycoon is about supply and demand and auction mechanisms. And Gods Love Dinosaurs is kind of about building an ecosystem or city management or what have you, but you only care about dinosaurs. So there's prey animals. You need prey animals. You're not really jazzed about them. You love dinosaurs. But the prey animals are useful because they can be eaten by predators. You don't really care about predators either. But predators are what dinosaurs like to eat. And so therefore you care about predators. And so consequently, you're in this position where you can score some points by eating a whole bunch of things, but you have to wonder, how much longer is the game going to be? Am I going to be able to breed more prey to feed more predators to feed more dinosaurs? Or is it time to just accept the fact that I'm just not going to have any rats anymore on my ecosystem and just hunt them to extinction, either to keep this tiger alive or to breed this new hawk, or because, hey, the dinosaur needs a snack and this just makes sense. On top of that, there's the further burden of the possibility of breeding more dinosaurs, which allows you to consume at a higher rate, but by the same token, imposes additional strain on your ecosystem. And this push and pull I find consistently fascinating. You find yourself in positions where, like, this board looks great. And then two turns later, you realize, I have no bunnies left, and this is awful. And the timing of the activation of animals really works. That's where the player interaction comes from. You're drafting these tiles to expand your ecosystem and get more animals. But the big thing of consequence is once the three tiles above a certain type of animal are drafted, the game pauses and all those animals activate. And if bunnies activate when all your bunnies are dead, that's not great. It's going to take you all the much longer to get those bunnies. If tigers activate and there's nothing for your tigers to eat, well, you're in serious trouble. And on top of that, there's when your dinosaurs activate. Casper Lapp is a super interesting designer. I can attest that Gods Love Dinosaurs is not a hat, which is another thing that Casper Lapp has taught me from popular culture. What is and is not a hat? This is very important.
That tracks.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you approve. And Gods Love Dinosaurs is another perennial favorite, sort of a light game of a collection, but nonetheless has a fair amount of teeth, no pun intended, and some tricky trade-offs. Gods Love Dinosaurs wins friends wherever it goes. That's by Casper Lapp, published by Pandasaurus Games 2020.
Lastly for me, a game that, Mark, have I talked to you about Harmonies yet?
You have mentioned it once or twice.
Once or twice. So this is designed by Johan Benvenuto and put out by Libelud. And it's just a great game. It's going to be easy to teach. I've yet to play it in real life. I've played it on Board Game Arena, but I can sense.
Walker, that's classic troll talk. The internet is real life.
It'll be easy.
You've not played it in person.
It'll be easy to set up. You just simply put out, you know, four cards and you populate this board with some tiles and you're ready to go. Or I should say discs. And the cards are different types of animals and it'll show you what kind of biome they want. Also, part of that biome, you're going to put a cube on it to show that you've built that biome. And then you draft your set of three discs that must go on your hexagon grid. And so you're looking at the different piles that are available. Because every turn you also get to take a new card. You're allowed to have four on the go at a time. So you're saying, I really need that water, but it comes with some stone. I don't have any animals that need stone right now. So you look at the sort of cards that are available. Okay, that needs stone. So I'll draft that animal and sort of start setting up for what he needs and finish these other things. And they can, the biomes can interconnect. So if this one needs a mountain and this one needs some grasslands, you can use the same tiles, except for the fact that you have to look at where that cube is going to go. Because if the cube goes on the same disc, then it's not, they're not going to mix together well. And so you're trying to figure out how to fit all of this together. And then on top of that, this is the key. You're going to get points at the end of the game, depending on sort of like landscaping that you've done. Mountains to, mountains together get more points. Long rivers get points.
Oh, so not like topiary or water features.
No.
Okay.
Just like sort of the way you've naturally done things. And there's also like the main cards that you're going to draft that have special abilities and stuff. Anyway, there's lots going on. Very much looking forward to seeing this in person.
Yeah, I'm curious to play it. I don't want to play it on Board Game Arena because I don't like online implementations, but you keep saying good things about it. And frankly, from the sounds of things and from the looks of things, I don't think it would run afoul of my dislike of spatial puzzles. I think instead it would just be able to have the standard efficiencies of tiling games. So I am optimistic.
I love it because of the time it takes. Literally, I can get, I think, 15 minutes on Board Game Arena if it's a two-player game.
Yeah, but that can be deceptive.
It can be. But I'm just saying, even just say if you're just only playing on Board Game Arena, I play it on the side while I'm doing other things. And the fact that it plays so quickly, very much enjoying Harmonies.
Finally, for me, we played another game of Rattle. Rattle is an independently produced 3D printed game from Andy Gallagher, who has named his publishing quote unquote house. I say that because, you know, he's literally publishing it from his garage. Busy Dad Games. This was crowdfunded last year from Australia. And Rattle is a couple of steps away from being genius, I think. Unfortunately, those steps are big. And it's a small grid, and there are these 3D printed, they're the shape of D8s. I don't know what the technical geometry term for that is. I'm sorry, I'm not one of those people. It's a dodecahedron parallelogram.
I knew.
Is that it? Did I nail it?
You got it.
Yes. And there's a whole bunch of different dexterity minigames. And the way it was pitched was, imagine a box that's got solo, two-player, and co-op kind of WarioWare-style dexterity challenges. So naturally, my computer keyboard had to recover physically from the extent to which I mashed the give this person money button. And it's charming. The art is charming. The different setups are charming. The variety of different minigames are charming. The problem is you cannot go more than literally a minute or so without some sort of very serious, crippling, game-breaking ambiguity. And let me just, I'll give the same example I did before because I don't want to belabor the point too much. I didn't know what next to meant until I watched the second video that had been posted on the crowdfunding page. Because these are the things that anybody who's ever played a game or has ever thought about this comes to next to. Does that include diagonals on a square grid? We're not talking advanced sort of, are people allied to themselves things? That's more like next level, you're a hobbyist gamer, you know to look out for these words. Adjacency is ambiguous on a square grid. I'm sorry. Anyway, but that is one thing that I just have to remember that has been resolved. There's a Discord available. I've showed up at the Discord to ask where I can ask rules questions, but the designer has not shown up to even acknowledge where rules questions might be asked because I have many rules questions about the core system, and then every new minigame introduces many more. What's an action?
What's an action? That's it.
Turn, we understand. Action, we don't. Because I don't want to pile on. I remain tickled by Rattle. I mean, basically, what you're doing is you take these dodecahedron parallelograms, and you toss them into the box. I will set aside the fact that how one tosses things into the box, where can your hand be? How far away do you have to be? Can you overlap? Can you draw? What's a toss? I'll set that aside. I said I was going to set these things aside. It is taking difficulty to set them all aside. But you're just, you know, throwing stuff in these charming games. On top of that, there are some like abstract positional requirements, but very, 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 very light. So you get movement allowances sometimes. Sometimes you're throwing things. Depends on the game you're playing. It's so close to joyous, and it is almost close to being genius, but as it is a novelty where you have to abandon all sense of clarity so as to avoid frustration. And that's where I am with Rattle.
That's why I always say it's just has so much potential. Yeah. The fact that it falls short makes it that much more aggravating.
Yeah, I agree. Rattle by Andy Gallagher. If anybody knows Andy Gallagher,
we have some questions.
We have a question or two. So those are the games we played this week. Now a brief break while we pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. And it's time for the news and why it doesn't matter.
Well, I'm going to deal with the biggest thing of the week. Everyone wants to know about. We have Monopoly Flavor Town, the Guy Fieri edition. Everyone's been waiting for this. Like, I thought they had all the Monopolies covered.
Yeah.
And then I realized what I was missing, right? You don't realize what you're missing until you see it.
Yeah, much like SEAL Team Flicks.
Flavor Town, baby.
Here's a question, though. What locations are there to purchase?
I don't even...
Like, does Flavortown have identified districts or streets? I've never been.
I don't care. Yeah, I just saw it, and I'm like, come on.
Walker, seriously? As established by our coverage of Rattle, we are inquisitive people, and we want these questions answered.
It's true. But yeah, say if you have your Monopoly collection, and you thought you were complete, well, you're not. You still have Flavortown to pick up.
Well, from the ridiculous to the sublime, I will remind people that the solo project by Greg Engelstein and David Thompson, two titans of the hobbyist board game design space. Their co-design, Zheng He, is on GMT Games P500. All you people who throw tons and tons of money at crowdfunding, I'm included in that. The P500 system on GMT is a glorious, civilized place where you're only charged very shortly before the thing is shipped to you.
But how many stretch goals they got?
Get out, Walker.
Do I get my name on the box?
How much spot UV is involved?
Exactly.
It is languishing a little bit on the P500. A listener pointed this out on the Patreon exclusive Discord, said, why don't you give this a shout out? And I responded the same way I always do, which is, I can't move copies, but I can try. Zheng He.
Well, we should send them a message. Include anthropomorphic animals, please.
Oh, and then. Good point. Good point.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, you're telling a story of a very, very, very famous historical Chinese figure, but what if that historical figure were part beaver?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, speaking of dumping tons and tons of money into crowdfunding, Cyberpunk 2077, the board game. Now, it's odd, because CMON already did this, but I guess they didn't do well. I did go back and I looked at that project again, just to see why there was such a difference.
Yeah, the gangs of Cyberpunk.
And yeah, it looks like just like a fan server. Here, oh, you want Cyberpunk? Yeah, here, these are the figures that were in the game. And here's a map that has the districts that are in the game. The game.
Yeah, but you're basically describing licensed games to begin with.
But not so much this new one. This
oh, yeah, it's very clearly, slavishly devoted to the characters of the video game.
This one,
the video game,
the models are very detailed. And make that and the whole,
well, the renders Walker,
and the whole layout,
the renders
of the CMON one is so un-CMON. I just didn't understand it, and it only made $886,000.
That's barely any money at all
compared to this one.
Yes,
which is by a smaller company, I would say, that is already at $3.5 million.
Woof.
19,000 backers. The CMON one only had 6,000 backers. And so this is a real-time dice and card playing game. It gives me like sort of XCOM vibes, whereas, okay, here's this mission. We're going on this mission. Get ready. And you all have sort of your specialties to do. You get to play all the characters you like from the video game. No point me going into them. If you don't know them, you don't know them.
What is Judy Alvarez doing here?
Not staying in the van. That's what she's not doing. And so you hit the timer. It does have an app, but you don't need an app. They already said, you know, you can track everything with pen and paper and just a normal timer of your
That honestly is the point that I'm most enthusiastic about, the fact that it is app optional, because I respect the fact that when you're doing a real-time mission-based game, making it app-driven is the kind of an obvious route, especially given the current market. But the fact that it is not required makes me very happy.
So the models look great. Everything I see so far looks great. Also already has CMON-related, oh, here's this expansion. Just tack another $50 onto your pledge. So there's different. You can get the standard, and that's what they did do that CMON does not do. There are two versions.
Minis just for the player characters, or minis for everybody for the deluxe version, which is the way every game should be.
But I mean,
be,
even for the expansion, though.
Oh, really?
CMON only does, you know, you get this expansion. If you didn't want the figures, well, you get the figures anyway. This one has two different.
Good for them.
So you get to choose which one you want.
Good for them.
Cheaper one. I may or may not have backed it.
Maybe.
Maybe. So I'll let you know in 3 years when it finally fulfills, because, you know, I'm sure it'll take that long for the 15 boats to get over, because these boxes are going to be huge.
I've been thinking about it a little bit, Walker. One of the reasons why I have a limited enthusiasm for Cyberpunk stories, I enjoyed Cyberpunk 2077 a fair deal. We'll certainly talk about it sooner or later on a podcast that you don't want me to talk about called All My Best Friends Are Digital.
That we've never mentioned before.
Walker, it hurts me. I enjoyed Edgerunners, but Cyberpunk stories, specifically in that universe, tend to be of a common theme, which is a very interesting theme, but it's one that I need the emotional reserves to deal with. And that theme is a bunch of dislocated, ambitious, countercultural folks whose desire for toys and inability to find satisfaction drive them to a premature end, right? Yeah. That's more or less the Cyberpunk vibe. And it occurs to me, could anything be more appropriate for hobbyist board gaming as specifically represented in crowdfunding than that vibe of Cyberpunk?
True.
So I think it's perfect. It's a perfect marriage. Finally, for me, Beyond the Horizon. So Beyond the Sun is a Euro game that we very much enjoy, designed by Dennis K. Chen. Full disclosure, someone I had some social contact with back in Massachusetts. He was the first person I ever know to acquire a 3D printer. I defy anyone to give a more specific or detailed disclosure anywhere on any podcast. And there's now going to be sort of a generic Civ-themed version with redeveloped mechanisms from Adam Hill, Ben Pinchback, and Matt Riddle. And it's going to be published by Cranio Creations. I have to say that Cranio Creations is definitely leading the pack of publishers I'd rather not support, but feel compelled to by virtue of the designs they sign. It is what it is. Not, they haven't really done anything particularly mendacious. It's just that their component design tends to be bad, their support tends to be bad, and they also do the thing that Walker finds obnoxious, which is when they run a crowdfunding campaign, they run an entire storefront for 50 million product lines, and it just gets a little bit complicated.
And future product lines.
And future product lines, exactly. But Beyond the Sun was great. Absolutely love the way it does tech trees. I think it's my favorite instantiation of a tech tree in a board game anywhere. And if Beyond the Horizon is adapting that to a kind of a more standard Civ type paradigm, I'm all in for it. I'm very curious to see what it is. It looks like they've made substantial mechanical alterations to the base formula, which is fine because the core element of the tech tree in Beyond the Sun, I think, is very flexible. You could do a lot of things with that, and I'm curious to see what they do. And this could be an entire line of games developed on the core design insights of Dennis Chan. That'd be wonderful. So that's Beyond the Horizon.
Lastly from me is a very niche kind of thing. If you love...
Oh, that's going to destroy our mainstream cred.
If you love
Mazinga, this is going to ruin us with the mommy bloggers.
I know.
This is required listening in several public school boards, Walker, because of how general and broad applicability the subject matter of Somebody Wrong About Games is. You're going to ruin it.
This will tighten it even more.
Okay.
So you have to like Miyazaki films.
Oh, well, that's not really narrowing it down too much.
And you also have to like either Othello or Reversi.
Okay, well, that is... that's going a little bit...
And I can't even help you find this. Because you have to go to the Othello on Board Game Geek, and they show you pictures of this Japanese-inspired Reversi games. And there are several of them.
Oh, yeah. Othello is huge in Japan.
So there's, you know, all the...
No, sincerely. Yes. Othello is huge in Japan, yeah.
So three different films. And they all have pieces based on those films.
Are these three different sets or three different films in one set? Okay, yeah.
Three different sets, and they, you know, there's character on one side, and you, when you flip them over, it's a different character.
Which films do you remember?
Oh, yeah, there's a Spirited Away, there Natch. Is Totoro.
Natch.
And there is Kiki's Cats.
Kiki's Delivery Service?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so, like I said, I can't even, because it's all in Japanese, so I'm sorry, I can't even tell you the company that's putting them out.
Okay.
And I can't tell you any information. I've given Mark the link. He's going to put it at the end of the podcast, so you can see the pictures, and then you can do your own sort of searching to try to find it, if that is your thing.
We used to have a very, very, very kind and generous listener who would, I'm tempted to say smuggle, but that's not the right term, send us the Sakura Arms content that was unavailable in the United States. I've not heard from this saintly individual in some time, but... Othello sets with Hayao Miyazaki characters. Have you watched The Boy and the Heron?
Not yet. That is the newest one.
I recommend it.
All right. I'm going to have to track it down.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's on Netflix. It's not particularly hard to find.
Oh, it didn't come up on my... All right.
So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our feature game, which is The Veil of Eternity, designed by Eric Hong, published by Mandu Games last year. Mandu Games is the Korean publisher, which is named after dumplings, which is definitely, like, I think that it is underappreciated. More things need to focus on the fact that dumplings are the finest food item you could ever have. I will take dumplings in any form. I will take your pierogi. I will take your stuffed bread. I will take any form of, I will take your raviolis, anything. I'm there for it. Anyway, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary as opposed to the very on-topic stuff that I've just been saying about The Veil of Eternity.
So Veil of Eternity is a tableau-building card game in which players start a slow creep to be the first one to get to 60 points until the first player lucks out on a round's card pool and drafts the game-breaking combo, then the game's over. Veil of Eternity.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I was worried when I wrote that, it'd be like, okay, now what did we talk about?
Okay, so here's the thing. I would like to focus, let's start by focusing on the stuff about Veil of Eternity that I genuinely like, because it's got some clever bits.
All right. Let's talk about the limitations.
Sure.
Because the limitations are what make it very interesting.
So yes.
You're going to be using this currency to buy your cards. And you only have sort of four slots in order to put these stones in. And
you are never permitted to have more than four pieces of currency.
And they come in ones, threes, and sixes. And so it leads to very interesting sort of the order in which you take your turn. So you sort of spend some of it to play cards, and then you sell some cards to fill that back up again. So it's this interesting sort of figuring out your turn in order to not exceed that, because you don't get change back. So if you only have two threes and the card costs four, well, then you're paying six to put out your four card. So it's this very interesting sort of making the best of what you can do with your cards. And then on top of that, you can only have a certain number of cards in your tableau, and that is based on the round number. So in the first turn, you can only get one card out, and then two, and then three, and so on. So that's a very interesting limitation as well.
So about the economy, what I really appreciate is that it makes the value of different pieces somewhat difficult to quantify. You know, a one isn't necessarily worth a third of a three. Three ones is worth much less than a single three. And a six, the value of a six is really hard to calculate, because in one way, six is larger than your overall capacity for your economy if you're just counting ones. And it's not like you can go above your limit, spend some, and then be okay. This is not a limit that is effectuated at the end of the turn. This is at all times. And so that card that generates two ones for you, it's really hard to figure out what that's worth. And so it makes things much less calculational than they might otherwise be. At no point in Veil of Eternity are you ever in a position to remotely think, like, I am now buying points at a rate of 1.25 monies per point. No, it's impossible to do calculations like that because of those economic limitations. I really like it. And then there are effects that allow you to turn stones into different kinds of stones. My favorite card in Veil of Eternity is one that says at the end of every round, you can either turn a three into a six or a six into three threes. Particularly because it leads to multi-round plans. If you really just want more purchasing power, you can just start with a three and just let that six simmer, and then it'll turn into three threes. But also because sometimes a six is better than three threes, and it's hard to figure out when you're actually making progress in that. So I love the economy.
There's also cards that make all your stones are worth one more than they are. So there's all these different ways in which they they changed that up, which I love.
And the limitation works on the same way. It took me a while. My first play and a half, I was looking at those cards that says, well, when you play this, discard some of your prior cards, thinking, oh, well, that's just a thing. I'm fine. I don't have to worry about it because all these other cards had instant effects and no persistent effects. Okay, I'm not paying the cost. No, dum-dum, it's not a cost. It's a benefit. You've just opened up more space for yourself. So getting rid of cards in your tableau is advantageous because so many of the powers are one-shots.
Yeah, because it gets very increasingly difficult because some of my, you might, I'll get into the different abilities, but one is, you know, an instant ability gets 6 points, but now that card's in your tableau. And if you get that out early enough, because it only costs the round, whatever round you're in, it costs that much money to get it out of your tableau. But if you leave it there too long or play it too late, it's going to be there for the rest of the game. And then selling cards. So there's five different families, sort of families of cards or suits of cards in this game. And each one sells for a different price.
I should point out there's a kind of a pen mythological theme that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Some of the art's okay. I mean, I like the art, but, you know, Odin doesn't feel Odin-y. Behemoth doesn't feel like Behemoth. There's a snail princess. I mean, there's just weird, you know, mixture of different mythologies of different mythoi and a variety of other strange stuff. It's just a hodgepodge of reasonably pretty cartoon pictures. That's
and yeah, I don't feel as though anything links anything together, in
not
my
a one.
Opinion.
Not a one.
So let me tell you how it plays quickly so you can, some of this stuff makes sense. At the beginning of the round, you're going to put out enough cards so there's two for every player. And then you're going to start drafting the cards, sort of furnace style, not really furnace style, but you have two tokens and in turn order, you're putting them out in serpentine fashion. And then you sort of now have the ability to do something with those two cards that you've drafted. You can either pick them up into your hand or you can sell them. And depending on what family they're associated with, we'll give you a certain number, like either three ones or a one and a three or a six or whatever it happens to be for that family. And then when it comes to your turn, you're deciding in whatever your order you want, which makes, this is what makes the game interesting because you're not locked down. It's like, all right, I'm going to play this card that I've had in my hand for like three turns, which is going to free up some of the spots in my thing. Then I'm going to sell that card that I reserved this turn. And then I'm going to take this other card into my hand that I reserved. And now I have enough money to play it. And then anyway, all sorts of interesting things.
Yes, the turn structure facilitates one of the virtues that you typically expect or want out of a tableau building slash drafting game of this ilk, which is to say a little bit of freedom to do some interesting combos. Like, well, I play this, which allows me to play this, which allows me to trigger this other thing.
And then once everyone has played, taken all their turns, there's also a permanent ability that, so you get to trigger all your permanent effects on your cards, and that could be all sorts of different things. But some cards are either instants, permanents, or always active. And the always active ones are the ones like we've already talked about that make all your stones worth one more or stuff like that. Where the permanent ones give you ability at the end of each turn, you know, get a three, pick up a card, all sorts of different things.
So I have a number of gripes about Veil of Eternity. It's a perfectly pleasant game. One of my gripes is that with two players, I find the draft to be too restrictive. I don't find the draft particularly interesting with two players. The moment you get to three or four, the number of cards that hit the table per round is enough that there's enough latitude. And there I find that the trade-offs are more difficult and more interesting. It also slightly alleviates, but not entirely, my next objection, which is there is no core way to score points in Veil of Eternity. The only way you're going to score points is as a consequence of specific card effects. What this does is creates a certain burden on the part of the card supply and the card throughput, because if it's not calibrated properly, you're going to have turns that don't matter and or windfalls that are inappropriate. And I think that in Veil of Eternity, you get both. I would like to contrast this with a game we actually played last week, which is Faerm. In Faerm, there's no default way to score points either. But you start the game with a couple of opportunities, a couple of ways to score points. They're very different games, I should acknowledge. But the core structure of the advantage of there's no like sort of core way to score points. It's all about the cards you play. It's all about how you navigate the world. There are ways to finesse this to make sure that it's not going to be as arbitrary and capricious as the Veil of Eternity sometimes feels. And Faerm does a good job of this by starting you off with some rudimentary ways to score points. And the market is staged so that as new point scoring opportunities enter the system, you get to see them before they become available for purchase, broadly speaking, and accommodate to the changing economy. In the Veil of Eternity, you might spend the first half of the game with no conception about where any of your points are going to be, whether you know the deck or not. There are some things you can try to hedge for. Yeah, there are a couple of cards that give you points based on how many different suits you have out in front of you. So sure, if nothing has come up, certainly nothing of substance, a point here, a point there, sure, whatever. But you might start to think, okay, so there's a minor pressure for me to start diversifying into different suits. Okay. And then maybe that card comes up. Maybe that card comes up in such a way that you're able to draft it and it's not snaked out from under you. Okay. But that's a lot of maybes. And even then, that's not going to get you all the way to 60. I just, at the end of the day, when it comes to playing around with combos, I think the Veil of Eternity is quite decent as far as tableau builders go. When it comes to actually pursuing victory, I think the Veil of Eternity needs to take a page from any number of Friedman Freeze or particularly Tom Lehman games, to be frank.
Yeah, like, and like you said, the two ways that the game can end, it goes to the full round number, or as soon as someone hits 60, then it's done. There is a family called the Dragons, and that's mostly what the cards Mark was talking about, which gets you big points. So you might be able to draft. You might know what they are and try to work towards one and hope that you might get it. Or you can just draft one early. So for early, maybe the experienced players would get them early, or maybe the experienced players will wait.
Well, but even beginner players might be inclined to take dragons anyway, because they're the ones that give you six value
true.
Stone.
Yes.
And so even if you haven't been building towards it, even if you don't know what you're doing, if you're earlier in draft order, none of the other ones really grab your attention, you might just do it for the economy and therefore prevent somebody else from scoring points that they've been building towards.
True. What I was going to say is that you draft it early and that gives you something to work towards as well.
Yes, when the dragons come out. We're just talking about a single undifferentiated deck,
yes,
right?
For sure.
So let me contrast this with a Tom Lehman design, which is completely unfair. Generally speaking, if you're going to be designing a tableau builder, it's kind of unfair to compare it to something by Tom Lehman. But then again, this is what happens when you design in a thoroughly crowded space, right? So Res Arcana. The economy of Res Arcana is, frankly, probably less interesting than the Veil of Eternity. It doesn't have those interesting restrictions, doesn't have those weird difficulties in terms of evaluating the relative value of stones based on the status of your tableau, what have you. But in Res Arcana, you know what you're building towards. There are these common point-scoring goals that hit the table that are different every game that might synergize with what you're working towards, maybe not. Maybe you're competing with the other players to get there first. Maybe you're not because you're going in different directions. But you know that there's a stable influx of point-based goals as opposed to Veil of Eternity, which I can't take particular... Okay, let me be very clear about something. I hope long-time listeners know what I'm talking about. When I say I can't take Veil of Eternity seriously as a competitive endeavor, that's not because I'm a super competitively oriented guy. It's just that sometimes a game is good because I feel like I'm pulling the levers and my success or failure is a consequence of those levers that I've been pulling. And sometimes I'm just pulling the levers because pulling levers are fun. When I'm playing Veil of Eternity, I'm just pulling levers because pulling levers is fun. And I can get some satisfaction out of this combination of powers I put in my tableau, which does weird things with swapping this stone for another thing and then cashing the stone in for a card and then getting a mitt full of 27 cards. And then I end the game with 20 points and lose and come in last place because the card that I needed to score points just didn't show up or disappeared due to random things. That's kind of where I'm at with the Veil of Eternity.
Yeah, I've played it several dozen times, I think, by now, because it plays so quickly and is easy to teach. Because a lot of the rules are mostly just on the cards, and you're just going to have to, like, suss it out as you play. Like,
it is vastly more approachable than lots of these other tableau builders that I've been comparing it to. That's absolutely true.
And exactly, you know, trying to explain to someone how it works, it's just easier just to start playing, and then they sort of see, it's like, well, this will get me 2 points every turn, and it's like, oh, if I play this, it'll let me pick this back up, which will let me play it again, and then it'll let me pick it back up again, or if I get three of this color out, I'll get this. So it has all these different combos that are going to work together in different ways every game. There's an expansion coming out, which will mix it up even more. More than likely, I'll pick that up just because it's a very interesting game that is accessible to many people.
A final gripe that I will offer, now that we're at it, is I have not played as much as you have, but I've played it for a number of times. You're right. It's very quick. It's very approachable. Another problem is that even after the third or fourth game, I felt like I'd seen all the cards. And, you know, the first couple times I was playing, I'm like, oh, well, that's an interesting combo that I can set up. And, yeah, you get new combos and new combinations of specific existing cards. But I stopped getting surprised or interested in what the card effects very quickly, given the card set.
So, yeah, but the thing with that is that if you're not surprised by the cards, just look over at the Dragon Standee. and then you're surprised again, and then you're good to go.
You're obsessed with the Dragon Sandy. There's this punchboard cardboard Dragon Sandy that literally is not mentioned in the rulebook and has no gameplay effect whatsoever. It's not even the start player marker. There's a separate start player marker, which is actually quite nice. I really like the wooden components.
It's true.
Pretty inoffensive. Some cute tricks. But ultimately, I feel it's just let down by the randomness of the card flop, especially in lower player count games.
Yes, especially in two-player games. Veil of Eternity.
That's the Veil of Eternity. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We really appreciate it. Thanks for spending the time with us. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. And as always, please do thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.